Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 128, I'm joined by Dr. Gene DeWan. We discuss his career and the lessons he learned about innovation, creativity, and entrepreneurship in retina. Our shameless plug for today, we will be conducting a first-ever online content for ophthalmologists marketing and education course at the annual American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting in Chicago. Our course will be Monday, October 29th at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. I will be on the panel with Drs. Osiwuma Abugo, Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, and Matthew Weed, and we will cover it all in that hour. You won't want to miss it. It should be fun and educational, and please, please come and support us. If you have any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Eugene DeWan. Dr. DeWan is a renowned retinal surgeon, an entrepreneur, as well as inventor. Currently, he serves as the vice chairman of Foresight Labs. He also is the Gene Kelly Stock Distinguished Chair in Ophthalmology at the University of California, San Francisco, previously at the Doheny Eye Institute at USC and the Wilmer Eye Institute in Baltimore, in addition to several other titles. Dr. DeWan, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to speak with you.
You've had a very interesting and distinguished career. We always ask our new guests, because we have so many younger residents, ophthalmologists, fellows who listen, they're curious often how people get to where they are. So were you always someone who, when you went to medical school, that you were planning to do an ophthalmology residency? At what point did you decide that you were going to become an ophthalmologist and then a retinal surgeon?
My father was an ophthalmologist, and I'm a junior, so I'm named after him. And I grew up in Alabama down in Mobile. And my whole life, I had my father's nurses and patients, oh, you're going to be a doctor like your father. And I said, well, maybe. And there was a joke in my family, I could do anything I wanted after I finished medical school.
But you still decided to follow in his footsteps.
Yeah, I loved ophthalmology. I really initially tried to kind of resist the temptation of doing exactly what he had done, but it was really kind of a crisis for me that I ended up being an ophthalmologist like my father.
Tell us a little bit about your career path, because again, I referenced it earlier, you're someone who's been at multiple very strong academic institutions in addition to your entrepreneurial and engineering kind of career, which we'll also talk about. How did you end up where you are today? So what sort of factors motivated you when you left fellowship, your initial job selection, and then in terms of how you moved around afterward?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say there was some plan, but there really wasn't. I was, trained at the Wilmer Institute. The way I got trained there was Dr. Momeny was from Mobile. Actually, Dr. Wilmer was from Mobile, Alabama. That was at a time when the good old boy network worked. And I was one of the few people that went from University of South Alabama to the Wilmer Institute. And so once I got into my father said I should, if I wanted to come back to Mobile, which I thought I did, practice with him. And he said, you needed to have something a little special if you're going to come back to Mobile, because you just can't be a general ophthalmologist. You need to have something else. And there's this guy down in Miami, his name is Mockamer, and I think you ought to work with him. So I said, okay, I'll go and work with Dr. Mockamer, not understanding what that was at all. I'm in medical school, and he's saying something like that. And so when I was in Wilmer, the only guy I really wanted to work with was this guy named Mockamer, and by that time he moved from Bascom Palmer to to Duke, and my colleague, Paul Sternberg, and I were both going into retina, and he knew that I wanted to go to Duke really bad because of this working with Mockimer, and of course I knew who Mockimer was by that time, and Duke was a great retina place. And so we both applied there, and he came to me one day, you know, after the match had come in, he goes, "Gene, I'm kind of sorry to tell you this, but you know, I got into Duke." And so I said, "Oh no, that's you know, very happy for you, Paul, but you know, I'm feeling a little bad." And then about an hour later, I get a call, and I'd gotten into Duke too. So I went to Duke. After about 3 months there, they said, "Do you want to? We want you to stay on faculty." And I said, "Okay, let me check with the family." And of course, I had three kids at that time, and none of them were really excited about, you know, staying on at Duke or staying anywhere except going back down to Alabama, where, you know, life was going to be pretty good. And but I wanted to say, "Well, I'll try it for a year, and if I'm no good, I can always go back to Alabama." And so for about 5 years in a row, I tried it 1 year at a time, and it worked out.
It's interesting how things just kind of evolve, you know, rather than, like you said, don't follow a discrete plan.
Right. There was no plan. It was just a year by year thing, and I was fortunate. It was a wonderful time to be at Duke. Absolutely, I mean, we were doing things. It was a very exciting time for vitreoretinal surgery in general. Mockimer was a wonderful thinker and teacher and surgeon, and we just really were. I was involved in a lot of very exciting things, and it gave me kind of a taste for invention and that I could make a difference. And I think that's where, you know, I had a long time desire to do science, have a master's in biochemistry, and, you know, probably would have been just a PhD scientist researcher if I didn't have the tradition of, you know, being a doctor first and then doing whatever I wanted to do, so to speak.
You know, one of the things you were involved in at Willmar was something that people talk about a little reverentially now is the Mad Lab. Tell us a little bit about what the Mad Lab was and kind of the impact it had on your career and the field in general.
So at Duke, we had a lab that was called the Biophysics Lab, and it had a machinist, Dyson Higginbotham, and a lot of things came out of that lab. And we made, if we did some invention or stuff, and we did a lot, you know, air pumps for vitreoretinal surgery and lasers for vitreoretinal surgery, intraocular laser, and iris retractors turned out to be for cataract surgery, but a lot of, just on and on, a lot of things. But the problem was is that there weren't engineers in the biophysics lab. And I said, "Well, we need to bring engineers into the hospital, into the operating room, see what we're doing. And I bet you they can and kind of make them part of the invention process." And that's what the Mad Lab was. It was, we had surgeons, we had doctors, and we had engineers, and we also had machinists and people that could make stuff. And so it was this kind of brain trust of, you know, bright young engineers wanting to get into medicine, and this living in the Department of Ophthalmology, living, being able to come up to the OR, see what we were doing, made it hugely productive and fertile. It was just, you know, I think we had over, in the 9 years I was there, we had over 100 invention disclosures, things like 25-gauge transcoaching tavel surgery came out, but just lots of stuff. I mean, we were using voice-operated machines and, you know, intraoperative OCTs back then. You know, so it was just, it was a crazy, wonderful time. Robotics. We had a vitreoretinal robotic system. You know, it was just, so it was a really fun time and very productive. And many people have gone through the Mad Lab, and I'm very proud of kind of that sense. And it also was it started being a more productive business opportunity. I mean, in other words, the inventions that came out of the Mad Lab were licensed and taken into small companies. And three or four of the inventions activities, you know, really actually were the foundation for different companies.
You know, and then after your time working at Wilmer and the Mad Lab, You moved on, and that at that time you went to, was it right? You went to University of Southern California Doheny Eye Institute.
Right. After about 9 years at Wilmer, I had wanted to, you know, kind of move to the kind of the what I considered the next level, which was most academic departments, all academic departments, still. Despite this experiment, which kind of wasn't as productive as I would have liked, we are, you know, the purpose is to do research, discover, see patients, provide service, get grants, write papers, you know, bring in money. So all of this was, that's the normal academic path, right? That's how you get promoted. That's how you get be recognition, you want to be famous, you want to discover stuff. Well, in truth, in a practical sense, none of that really makes patients better. I mean, that, individually taking care of patients, of course, is wonderful. But businesses tend to develop therapies. Individuals don't develop therapies. It's too complex an effort to do as a single individual. There may be a scientist that discovers a new drug, but there needs to be, you know, 100 people involved in making that drug available to, you know, the people. So I had a thought that maybe we could act more like a business, that we would take on business titles, and that we would not emphasize activities like grant getting and paper writing and patient care, that we would emphasize our impact on the quality of life of people. So we would measure a single measure, and we would use this kind of sense, this corporate sense, this combined sense of accomplishment, like you do in a company. You know, you say, well, you know, I was at Apple when I was the first 100 employees at Apple, and we made it happen. You know, it's not a single person that makes something like that happen. So it's a good thought. It's a really good thought, and maybe even a right thought, but it's not a true thought. In universities, it really does matter how many papers you write and how many grants you get and how many patients you see. It just does. And that, just because I was going to try to change it a little bit, didn't mean it was going to change. And how do you pay for that? And how long does it take before you see the results of something like that? And so that's now there's a lot of discussion about translational efforts, and that was an early one. And I would say I wasn't very successful in that. I lost eventually. You know, I think the team lost confidence in that model, and basically in my ability to implement it. So that allowed me to go to the next step, which was coming to Northern California and setting up Foresight.
Tell us a little bit about Foresight. What is your role? What are the goals of the company? And what sort of technologies are you looking at?
So coming off what I considered was a failure at USC, you know, trying to combine business activities or development activities in a unified way into an academic structure, realizing that was probably not the right thinking, that I separated then my activities of development and fully put that into an outside of the university structure called Foresight Labs, which was really just me and some support, I mean, some financial support by several groups of investors, Bill Link at Versant, and Robin Bellis at one of the investors called Morgan Taylor. And we set it up it was a venture funded effort. And the other, all my clinical activity, which I enjoyed teaching and being still active as a doctor, just because I just defined myself like that, is UCSF brought me in and, you know, gave me this nice title of distinguished professor, and that's what I've been doing for the past 15 years. At Foresight, my role is really as an inventor and as a leader to guide new developments, particularly in ophthalmology. We're focused primarily in ophthalmology and have started now 7 companies, of which 5 have partnered or exited, and so that's a pretty good track record.
You know, you kind of hit this point already, but we'll talk a little bit more about it. Kind of bridging the gap between the industry / creative side, I guess. Is creative is maybe not the right word, but the inventive side of our field. And all of medicine depends, as you mentioned and referenced, on innovation. And no, retina is no different. And retina has been, from both the medical retina and surgical retina perspective, very dependent on innovation to advance as quickly as it has. And how to bridge the gap between that innovation, which is a lot of times easier, as you said, in the business model than in traditional academic medicine, which, again, as you referenced, relies on grants and a lot of times national funding and public funding. Can that gap be bridged successfully? Or do you see the evolution of how things have gone and how things have gone over time trending towards where most of the innovation is going to continue to come from the private sector rather than the public side?
I think as a physician, as a doctor, we are focused on patient care. We want to see our patients get better. We don't really care how they get better. I mean, that's not entirely true. But if it's in ophthalmology, certainly, if it's a drug makes you better, that's wonderful. If it's a surgical technique that makes you better, that's great. If it's a device that makes you better, wonderful. If it's an earlier diagnosis or whatever it is, we are completely satisfied and happy that we can make the patient better. We don't have to discover anything new. in a way to make the patient, if we make the patient better. If we could, for example, cataract surgery, okay, we have a better suction, we have less surge, we have less endothelial cell damage, but we don't, most cataract surgeons, most ophthalmologists, don't have a very strong interest in understanding why you get cataract, right? And that doesn't mean it's not important. It's just not important to us, really, because we have a really good way of taking care of it. And so I think research and grant writing, traditionally, it has to do with discovery, and it has to do with, finding out new things. To make something better, like cataract surgery, which is hugely important. I mean, 30 million of these procedures done, right? If you make cataract surgery 10% better, you've had a huge effect on public health. But, maybe a lot more than, many other things. So I think it's one of the things that I've done in my life is really try to say making people better is a very worthy goal. And don't be embarrassed because you didn't discover something. Actually, don't be embarrassed that you're not first on the paper. Just make a difference. Just help and make people better. And as doctors, we know how to do that. We know how to do it on an individual basis. We know actually how to do it together. We know what the problems are. We see them every day. And we just don't necessarily, we know how to make the clinic run better. We know how to make the medical records better. We know how to apply drops better. We know how to do surgery better. It doesn't take us long to think of a better way to do something. We just don't tend to take that next step and do it because we're not really asked to do it. We're not rewarded to do it. And a lot of times we're not given the resources to do it. But it doesn't take too much resources. And I'm kind of one of the reasons that I started doing some of this was to say, I'll give you an example. These both things are really good and really important. If I come up with a new class of glaucoma medicine, I can make in the market, companies that are worth $2-3 billion. If it's a drop, we know that half of the people don't take drops. So if I had a perfect drug that I gave once a day and it would absolutely stop the progression of glaucoma, it's only going to work half the time. And so what about these other half of the patients? What to do about them? And it's not as sexy a problem, not nearly as sexy a problem as understanding a new mechanism of IOP lowering medically. That's exciting. You found a new receptor, you found a new mechanism, and people, that could get you not only a lot of money, but a lot of fame. Getting a drop that beeps if it's not used, just almost as a joke or a delivery system that takes away that as a problem, even though it has an equal or bigger impact to get patients that are not treated now treated. It's the type of thing that appeals to me, and it's completely possible, It's not science. It's not science. It's really what it is solving a huge problem. So I drop compliance, for example. And we've done that, and I think it's really important. Getting injections in your eye every month or two. I mean, what a terrible thing to have to go through, right? I mean, it's just that as a vitreoretinal surgeon that we're trained to give injections, look at OCTs and give injections, that I think, you know, whatever the artificial intelligence efforts are going to be able to diagnose the OCTs better, and pretty soon they'll figure out maybe better ways of injecting. But why not just do something that, you know, would last a year? And people are doing that, and it's exciting and it's valuable, but it's not really the same type of science. It's not discovery. It's really a application of technology. So it's like building bridges and buildings and, you know, wonderful things, but it's not really discovery.
Right. Those are all really, really insightful commentary on the current state of affairs. You know, so this leads into our last point. I'll let you finish. You kind of referenced this when you talked about unmet needs in ophthalmology. You referenced glaucoma medication. You referenced the need for sustained therapy, for example, for medical retina diseases such as macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and vein occlusion. What do you see as the biggest thing on the horizon? Is the biggest thing you see going to be those longer durability drugs? Is it something that we haven't even talked about or considered at this point? If you had to project for a younger retina fellow what their career is going to look like in 20 or 25 years in terms of patient care, what sort of crystal ball predictions can you make or not make at this point?
First of all, absolutely, 100%, everybody should go into retina, okay? I mean, so if you're in retina, you've made the right decision. If you're considering retina, you know, just go ahead and do it. It's the place you need to be. The future, the reason I'm so excited about retina is that we know more about the genetics of retina and retinal diseases, including AMD and diabetes and glaucoma, and as well as RP and all of the retinal degenerations. This is gene therapy, and particularly gene therapy in the eye, I personally think it's one of the most exciting areas of all medicine. I personally think it's the most exciting area of all medicine because we know the most. And now we're beginning to have the tools. I mean, we've had the first approved gene therapy with Spark and what's done there, but it's really every day we tend to see something, a new effort that's starting, a new effort that is going to the next level. And I think we're going to be totally blown away by what we can do and what we need to be doing and treating diseases. We're going to prevent AMD. It's going to be something like that. We're going to vaccinate against AMD. I'm certain. I'd just be so excited to be part of that. And I've been a surgeon, and I developed a lot of surgical techniques, and I like that, and that's good. I love drug delivery, but I love the idea of curing disease.
Well, Dr. DeWant, these have been very inspirational words, and I really thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us and our listeners. You kind of sold retina hard, 100%, to the younger doctors listening. Thank you so much, sir. You have a wonderful day, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. All 128 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. We have a blog post coming out in honor of our 130th episode. You won't want to miss that. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback, both things we can do better, things we're already doing well, and ideas for future episodes. And you can always leave a positive comment in the form of a review. This is much appreciated in the iTunes Store or the Android Store. Many thanks to Dr. Dewan for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, and Angela Chang for producing and publishing this great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.